All right. Good morning, everybody. Maybe I'll turn the volume down just a little bit. There, how's that? All right, so today is October 24th, Monday. Last time you had a test. Those results are in Blackboard if you want to look at the results. And then in lab, you get to check your Scantron, make sure it's graded properly. And so we're going to continue on with some nervous system lectures. I think I want to turn the volume down just a little bit more. Maybe that's even better. Okay, but this week you also have practicum. So the first practicum class is out of the way, the muscles. And then you got three more depending on where they are. So let's continue with nervous system. And you already have an introductory chapter under your belts on nervous system. If you're going to take the whole nervous system, break it down into two main areas, what are the two main divisions? CNS and PNS, right. All right, and so we're going to talk about central nervous system today. What are the two main regions of the central nervous system? There are two main regions. Okay, what are the two main regions? You might want to take your lecture notes out from the introductory chapter, and it's the very first one that shows a nice flow diagram. Brain and spinal cord, that's right, brain and spinal cord. And from your bones, which is a hint, from your understanding of bones, what separates the brain from the spinal cord? There's a structure. Ah, foramen magnum, that's right. So as soon as all those neuronal tissues leave the cranial vault through the foramen magnum, then it becomes the spinal cord. So spinal cord is inferior to foramen magnum. Everything superior to it is what? Is your brain. Yeah. And what we have right here, oh, no, you don't see it. Let me slide it over. All right. What we have right here is a sagittal section of the central nervous system. However, it does not show the entire spinal cord. But let's just say that this region right here, right, is the foramen magnum, so everything below that is the spinal cord, and then everything above it is going to be your brain. So we're going to look at some different divisions of the brain. Right? The oldest part, in an evolutionary sense, is the most inferior part, and that is the brain stem. So here is the brain stem, and it includes the pons and the medulla oblongata, and these control some very rudimentary central nervous system functions. For instance, right, regulating heart rate and blood pressure and even respiratory rate is controlled in these different compartments right here. Right, and blood pressure in the medulla oblongata. So that's the first bump that you see coming from the spinal cord. And what else does the medulla do? Oh, it also regulates your blood vessels. So it helps regulate blood pressure. So those are some important functions of the medulla, right? But it also relies on the pons to some extent to do some of these things. Another function here of the pons is that it wraps around, there are tracks that wrap around from the pons into the cerebellum. It acts as a relay center for movement, for balance information, because that's the job of the cerebellum over here, to help maintain balance when you're in motion. Another function of the brainstem is that there is not just a structure, but it's a whole interrelationship of neurons right here that we call the reticular activating system, or RAS, or reticular formation. And these are where those reverberation circuits are at. Who can remember what a reverberation circuit is? You stimulate it once, and what happens? It self-stimulates, right? So it becomes active over and over and over again, and that provides for a wakeful state. So reticular activating system in the pons and the medulla is important for, right, for making sure that you stay awake during the day. And some people have lesions in this part of the brain, and the RAS is not functioning, and so they can fall asleep at just any time, at a moment's notice, driving down the 405, giving a lecture in class or whatever, right, just fall asleep. Does anybody know what that condition is called? That would be narcolepsy, right? So that's a fairly dangerous circumstance, and if you're diagnosed with narcolepsy, then I'm sure you lose your driver's license, because we just can't have people driving around falling asleep, right? All right, so this right here is the brain stem. Come on, cursor. So here is the brain stem, right there. What are some other things that I... Oh, yeah, coughing, vomiting, sneezing are some other important functions. Okay, in the midbrain... Okay, oh, and in my classification, I got the midbrain right here. That is also... Oh, midbrain? Yeah, do I have it as part of the brain stem? Well, I do have it as part of the brain stem. Okay, so so all of this right here. Oh, and you know what I see right now? I see like a different color. You see a different color from here to here? This looks a little bit darker compared to here. So that probably is where the foramen magnum is located, right? So that shows you the difference between brain and spinal cord. Right here is the midbrain. And this part of the midbrain, the anterior part of the midbrain, is what we call the cerebral peduncle. And a peduncle, it sounds like a really strange word, but let me give you a very simple definition of a peduncle. A peduncle is a bridge from one part of the brain to another, two very important parts of the brain. For instance, like a connection between the pons and medulla right here to the higher centers of the brain, like the cerebrum, the cerebral cortex. So there are many tracks that carry information up and carry information down through this tissue right here. And so this is a bridge. If information wants to travel from the cerebrum down into the brainstem, it has to pass through the cerebral peduncle. So think of a peduncle as a bridge. And we said that the pons is connected to the cerebellum, right? So again, there's like bridge material going from the pons into the cerebellum and vice versa. And guess what we call all of those fibers, which you can't see because they're lateral, right? We only have a midline section, but the pons kind of wraps around posterior into the cerebellum right here. Guess what we call that tissue that connects the pons with the cerebellum right here? Here's a hint. The tissue that connects the brainstem with the cerebrum is what we call a peduncle. And since it's connecting the cerebrum to the brainstem, we call that the cerebral peduncle. Take a guess what that tissue is that connects the pons to the cerebellum right here. It's a peduncle as well. It's not labeled on this diagram because you can't see it very well, though there you have some pictures in your textbook I'll show you in a second. But it's not the cerebral peduncle. This is a cerebellar peduncle. Okay, so here is the cerebral peduncle and cerebellar peduncle. Let me see if I can find the cerebellar peduncles. Oh, here's a pretty good picture. All right, so here's a little bit different view. It's kind of a three-dimensional view, where I can see the spinal cord down over here. This first bump is the medulla. The second bump is the pons, right? And then it's kind of coursing out of the picture toward us, right? And then it's going to wrap around into the cerebellum. So these are the cerebellar peduncles. And you can see there's three divisions. There's a superior, a middle, and an inferior. You don't have to know that. I just want you to know that that is the cerebellar peduncle. And the pons is a relay station for signals entering and leaving the cerebellum right here. And what we were talking about is the midbrain, which is above the pons. Here is the cerebral peduncle. And then these four little bumps right here are what we call the corpora quadra gemina. Corpora means how many? Four, right? Four little bodies. And these two up here are the superior colliculi, and these two down here are the inferior colliculi. They have different kinds of functions. The inferior colliculi are for localizing sound. It allows you to tell where sound is coming from. So if somebody opens and closes a door and I don't see them walk in the room, I have my eyes closed, I can tell if it's this door over here on my right, or my left, or up in the front of the room, because these inferior colliculi allows me to compare the time when signals reach my right ear compared to my left ear. And if a signal reaches my right ear before my left, my brain knows that the sound is coming from my right. And if it arrives at exactly the same time, it's what? Right smack in the middle someplace. Okay, so that's the inferior colliculus for localizing sound. The superior colliculi is plural for colliculus, which is singular. So the superior colliculi right here allow your eyes, so this for visual reflexes, allow your eyes to fixate on something, okay, and separate it from other objects in your visual field, and then track it as it moves around. So that's pretty important. Like, for instance, baseball players have to have really advanced superior colliculus, right? So as soon as somebody hits a baseball and it starts flying through the air, how does a baseball travel through the air? A nice straight line forever and ever? No, it falls back to earth, right? But it might have spin, so it might start curving one way or the other or dip down. These superior colliculi right here allow a baseball player to fixate on that baseball and then predict where it's going to be at a certain period of time. Right, so that's a visual reflex. All right, let's look at this diagram right here. Let me contrast that with another part of the brain. All right, so here is the cerebrum. And the cerebrum, when it receives electrical impulses, that gives us the perception of reality. That's where our consciousness comes from, the cerebral cortex, right in this region, this dark matter, right on the surface of the brain. All right, so when electrical activity reaches the cerebral cortex, you have the awareness of your reality, right? But not when the colliculi receive electrical information. These things just allow your eyes to track objects, okay? There was an interesting case in the news for quite a long time. People were fighting back and forth. The case was Terri Schiavo was the person's name. No one ever figured out what happened to her, if somebody actually strangled her, if she overdosed on drugs. But anyway, the end result was that the cerebral cortex died. And does anybody have an idea of what happens to some part of your body when it dies? It dissolves away, whether it's bone tissue or whatever, but it dissolves away. So this part of her brain completely dissolved away. They could never find anyone. They did an MRI or CT or anything. But the brain stem, okay, it was still alive. It was still intact. All right, so with somebody without a cerebrum, could they perceive reality? No, they have no perception of reality whatsoever. But if the superior colliculi were still operating, what reflexes did that person still have? Their eyes still could fixate on an object and track it around in space. So I remember seeing pictures in the news where a physician would walk into her room and take a pencil and put it in front of her eyes, right? And her eyes would latch onto that pencil, and then the physician would move the pencil and her eyes would move back and forth, right? And the physician said, well, that is evidence that this person was looking at a pencil and considering the pencil and following it around in space, all right? Even though all of the medical evidence showed that but the cerebrum had disappeared, so that person had no idea what they were looking at. That was just a simple reflex, okay, due to these superior colliculus. And that was the basis of that legal argument and the reason why she was kept on life support for years and years. And I don't know, would you want to be kept on life support for years and years if you had no perception of reality around you and had no chance of ever perceiving anything again? No, that was a shame that that actually happened, okay. Irrespective of any kind of legal or religious argument, okay? So that's why it's important to know all the different parts of your brain. All right, so auditory reflexes for these inferior colliculi and superior colliculus is for what? Visual reflexes are real important here. Okay. Reticular formation we talked about already. Let's talk about the diencephalon a little bit. The diencephalon is made of the thalamus and hypothalamus right here. So let me show you a picture of where these things are at. All right, so here we got spinal cord, right? Then the brain stem, including the medulla, the pons, and the midbrain right here. The diencephalon probably is colored in like a blue color, maybe purple or something, whatever color this is right here. All right, so here is the thalamus. It kind of looks like a walnut. It's about that size. And it has two lobes. There's one on the right, one on the left. And then down below the thalamus is the hypothalamus, right? That's how it's named. And can anybody remember what the job of the pons is? What are the jobs of the pons? Okay. Yeah, it has a lot of different jobs. And so I hear some really good answers. And maybe I heard it acts as a relay station for signals entering and leaving the cerebellum, right? So a relay station. That's what the job of the thalamus is. It is also another relay center. And it's a relay center for sensory information. Okay. What's another name for sensory? Can you remember? Afferent. And which way is sensory information going? From the cerebrum down to the spinal cord, or from the spinal cord up to the cerebrum? Afferent. Which way is it going? We haven't mentioned this exactly yet, so it's kind of like you're going to have to extrapolate your knowledge. But it's afferent is signals in the spinal cord arising through all of these different parts of the brain on their way to the cerebrum right here for your perception of reality. So all sensory information has to stop at the thalamus, and it's the job of the thalamus to direct that electrical information to the proper parts of the cerebral cortex. Because each part of the cerebral cortex has a little bit a different function. All right, so maybe we can go over that just a little bit. Here is one lobe of the cerebrum. The cerebrum has four major lobes to it, and you're probably aware of what the names of these lobes are because you know your bones. So what lobe of the brain is this right here? What bone is associated with this part? Occipital, right? So here's occipital lobe. And then here is the frontal lobe, and then right over here, posterior to the frontal lobe, is the parietal lobe. We'll talk about the differences between these different lobes. But here's a nice separation between occipital lobe and parietal lobe. The occipital lobe is important for vision. Right? So visual signals get into the occipital lobe because the thalamus tells them to go into that division over there. All right, so that's part of the job of the thalamus. But the thalamus has other kinds of functions, right? It's important for controlling your mood and also for the perception of generalized pain. If something is irritating you, right, you might not know exactly where it is, but this is what allows it to arise to the level of consciousness. And when it arises to your consciousness, then you can actually try to localize it to some part of your body. Okay, hypothalamus. Another part of the brain is very important because this is a center right here that controls your sensation of thirst and hunger. So when you become dehydrated, there are sensors right here that monitor how much water is in your blood or how much salt is in your blood. Those are kind of opposite concepts. So if the salt concentration of your blood increases, that gives you the sense of what? Thirst, so that you'll drink some water to decrease the saltiness of your blood or your body. Right? Temperature regulation takes place in this part of your body. So if the brain temperature increases, guess what the hypothalamus does? Yeah, it makes you sweat, which then, right, reduces your body temperature. Another important part of the hypothalamus right here is that it can secrete some hormones, which controls the pituitary gland, which is down underneath it. Right? So here is thalamus, hypothalamus, here is the pituitary gland, and the pituitary gland secretes many hormones which control a whole bunch. Oh, you studied this for the last test, right? All different kinds of functions, right? Like for growth, right? And for reproductive function and thyroid function, all the hormones in the anterior pituitary. The hypothalamus also synthesizes two hormones, which then gets transported down through tracts through the pituitary stalk right here to the posterior pituitary. Anybody remember the two hormones that are released from the posterior pituitary? ADH, antidiuretic hormone, and oxytocin, right? So ADH is released when you want to conserve water, when your blood is way too salty. And oxytocin contracts smooth muscle in our bodies, like for parturition, causes the uterus to contract. It also causes contraction of smooth muscle of glandular tissue in the breast. So it ejects milk from the breast for nursing an infant, for instance. All right, so those are some functions of the pituitary. And this tissue right here that connects the hypothalamus to the pituitary, it's a bridge between these two major parts of the brain. Most people don't consider the pituitary a part of the brain, but remember that posterior part really is an extension of the brain. So you could consider it really a part of the brain. What do we call this bridge material between two major parts of the brain? Like here is the cerebellar peduncle, here's the cerebral peduncle. You could consider that a peduncle, but nobody ever does because it's such a thin bridge. You could consider this a pedunculito if you wanted to. Okay, just a little peduncle. Okay. Now don't tell anybody I told you that though. Okay. So that's what a peduncle is. So that's the thalamus and hypothalamus. All right, the cerebrum. This is the largest part of the brain. So here is the cerebrum, this whole region right here. And it performs a number of important functions. So I want you to know some of these functions by location. But before we get to that, all right, here is kind of a superior view of the cerebrum. And is the cerebrum nice and flat and smooth, or do you see a bunch of wrinkles? It's very wrinkly, right? Okay. And these wrinkles are what we call convolutions. A convolution is a wrinkle. So a wrinkle is a depression. What do we call a depression on a bone? Anybody remember? Like between the tubercles on a humerus? A sulcus, yeah. Okay, a fossa you could call a depression, but this is a long, really long fossa, long and narrow. Typically we call that a sulcus. So a convolution is made up of a sulcus followed by this raised area right here, which is what we call a gyrus. All right, so the surface of the brain is all folded up. So you have a sulcus followed by the raised part, which is called what? A gyrus, followed by a low part, which is called what? A sulcus, which is followed by a gyrus, which is followed by a sulcus, over and over and over again. Okay? So what gives animals intelligence is just the surface area of the cerebral cortex, right? And if this was a flat cerebrum, then this brain wouldn't fit inside our heads. It'd be way too big. How do you take something that's really nice and flat and big and make it fit into a smaller space? Let's see if I can do this. I might be able to do this. How do you take something? Oh, this is pretty good. So here's an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, right? And if we wanted to put this in our heads would have to be what? At least 11 inches wide. Well, that would be kind of cumbersome. So through evolution, what has happened to the surface of our brain so that it fits inside our head? It's been folded up. Okay, so if we fold this piece of paper up, all right, now will this thing fit inside my head? Easy, right? So convolutions are folds so that a large surface area can fit inside our cranial vault. Okay, so the lobes of the brain, we can also see on this diagram. So in the anterior part, we have the, what kind of lobes of the brain? These are, you could say anterior lobes, but that wouldn't be quite right. These are the frontal lobes. Right here are the occipital lobes. What do we have between frontal and occipital? We've got parietal lobes, okay? Furthermore, the brain is separated by a large fissure. So a fissure is like a sulcus, except it's many, many times deeper. And it actually acts as a separation between the cerebral hemispheres. Right, so this longitudinal fissure separates the cerebrum from the right half and the left half. It's very, very, very deep. Okay, so that's a pretty good view of the cerebrum. Oh, there's something else I wanted to show you. Okay, I can't find it right at the moment. This will be good enough for now. Okay, so here is just a little section, right? And we can see the cerebral hemispheres or the longitudinal fissure. So let's zoom into this region. All right, so here we see a superficial layer of the brain compared to a deep layer of the brain. So what do we call a superficial part of any organ? The cortex. So here is the cerebral cortex, and you can see that it's dark. So this is gray matter, Right? Here's a deeper part of the brain, and can you see that it's a different color? Yeah, it's white, right? So the cortex is gray matter. These deeper parts are mostly white matter. Can anybody tell me from the previous chapter what makes up gray matter? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites, right? This contains non-myelinated tissue. But white matter, on the other hand, what makes up white matter? Okay, myelin sheaths. And where are myelin sheaths found? Around what part of a neuron? The axons, right? So there are tracts in this region of the brain. These are axons that are carrying electrical information long distances, and they're myelinated, so they have a white appearance. But up in the gray matter right here, you have nerve cell bodies and dendrites. So these are where all the connections are between the different cells in our central nervous system, at least our brain. Okay. And that's what gives people intelligence. Okay, the frontal lobe. So we talked about gyrus and sulcus. The frontal lobe, let's go back to the brain a little bit. Okay, it has some different functional areas. One thing I didn't mention, which is real important, all right, what do we call a depression on the surface of the brain? What's that called again? Sulcus. What do we call a raised area? A gyrus. All right, there is one sulcus that I want you to become, actually there's two, but here is one sulcus that I want you to know. We call this the central sulcus. It's a depression. It separates the frontal lobe from the parietal lobe, right here. And so the gyrus that is just anterior to the central sulcus, and this, we call that the central sulcus is because it's right in the center of the brain. Anterior to the central sulcus is what we call the precentral gyrus. Precentral because it's what? In front of the central sulcus. And then there is a gyrus that is just posterior to the central sulcus, and we call that the postcentral gyrus. All right, so the precentral is the first part of the frontal lobe, and the postcentral gyrus is the first part of the parietal lobe we see right here. And the central sulcus separates them out. All right, so this precentral gyrus, this first one right here, and it looks kind of red-colored to me, this is what we call the primary motor cortex. What kind of signal is a motor signal? Okay, it's efferent. That means that it's a signal that starts in the brain, goes down to the spinal cord, goes out to your body, and then it makes effector organs work, like skeletal muscle, glands, and things of that nature. But this primary motor cortex is for your somatic motor system. So when these areas of the brain start electrical activity, that means it's going to generate motor effects in some part of the body. Right, that's why I call this the primary motor cortex. So if we took an electrode and stimulated this part of the brain right here, you'd have some part of your body moving as a result of that. So you wouldn't perceive, if this one gets stimulated, some part of your body is going to move. So one of the main functions of the frontal lobe is that it controls what? Motion in your body. All right, so how are you going to remember that the frontal lobe is responsible for motor activity or the initiation of efferent signals? I can think of a pretty easy way. Where do you have the motor in your car? In the front. So think frontal lobe, motor. But motor is not just an engine, gasoline engine. It's what? It's where signals originate to go control effector organs in your body, especially skeletal muscles. Does anybody have a car with a motor right smack in the middle of the car in here? No? That's a shame. Okay. That would be a real fancy car. Okay, so most of us have motors in the front. All right, which means then the other lobes of the brain are important for sensory information. So signals are going to enter the central nervous system and go to these parts of the brain for your perception of reality around you. Okay, another thing about the frontal cortex, besides this primary motor cortex, we have Broca's area right here, right? And Broca's area is important for speech, right? So it requires a lot of motor activity for breathing, for instance, and operating your tongue and lips and things like that, and coordinating everything. So a lesion in Broca's area means that somebody can maybe still comprehend speech, but just can't speak back, even though they might know an answer to something, or they might want to carry on a conversation with somebody, but they just can't. They just don't have the motor activity available to them. And then in the prefrontal cortex, the most anterior part, right, this is the part of the front of the brain that gives us our personality, gives us skills such as solving complex problems, gives us skills in interacting properly with other people, things of that nature. So it is possible to miss part of the prefrontal cortex, but what would somebody be like if they have damage to their prefrontal cortex? They might say really inappropriate things at the wrong time, okay? And there's a really good example that they use in a psychology class where there was a railroad worker who was working on a railroad, and he put some dynamite charges in a hole and was tamping it down with a big iron rod, and the TNT blew up, and this big metal rod went right through between his mandible and out his frontal cortex, and he survived just fine, except it destroyed that part of the brain. And before that happened, he was a really good employee, showed up to work exactly on time, but then after the accident would show up late, start fights all the time with his coworkers, and was very inappropriate. And I think his name was Phineas Gage, came back to me. Okay, you could do a Google on him and see what happened to him. All right, so that's the frontal cortex, but what I really want you to know is the frontal cortex is involved with what, afferent or efferent signals? Efferent, right, for controlling parts of your body. All right, so let me slide this out of the way. Oh, okay. I want to talk about the homunculus right now for just a little bit. Let's go back to this picture right here. Okay. So what color is the precentral gyrus on this diagram? The precentral gyrus. You see it red? Okay. And what is the function of that precentral gyrus? Is it motor or sensory? Motor, because frontal lobe is motor. All right, so let me put this away for a second. And then you should probably remember that the postcentral gyrus is what? Is blue? Yeah, it's sensory, but what color? Bluish? Blue, okay. So let's look at a cross-section, okay? One cross-section through the red, and one cross-section through the blue, and it's going to be a coronal section, right? So it's going to be a coronal section, and here we have it right here. So do we have red and blue? I hope. All right, so there is the central sulcus, and we got these couple sections through there. All right, so the red was what? The primary motor cortex in the frontal lobe. So for it, and we can see what? A diagram superimposed on the cortex of various parts of your body. And it kind of reminded somebody of a person, and we call that a homunculus. And of course, it's not connected exactly how it is as you're sitting there on your chair. But if we were to electrically stimulate this part of the cerebral cortex, guess what would happen? If we were to electrically stimulate this part of somebody's cerebral cortex, and remember, this is the precentral gyrus, deep down in that longitudinal fissure, what would happen to this person? Your toes would wiggle, okay? Or, for instance, if we stimulate this region here, what would happen? Your thumb would extend or flex, for instance. And if we stimulate this area right here, what would be the result? You'd have like a contraction of the orbicularis oculi muscle, okay? So, for instance, if somebody had a stroke in this region of the brain right here, and again, that's frontal lobe, all right, what would happen? They wouldn't be able to move their lips very well. They'd have trouble eating, right? Or if there's a stroke in this part between the frontal lobe, and this looks a little bit like the temporal lobe down over here, then somebody couldn't eat because they couldn't swallow, right? So remember, this is all the motor cortex. But now, if we hop across that central sulcus and go into the postcentral gyrus, right? This is no longer a motor cortex. This is what? Sensory. So that if we were to electrically stimulate this part of the cortex, right, what would happen? Would some part of this person's body move? No, they would have a sensation in this part of their body, like they feel like they have an itchy nose or something. Okay? Or if if we stimulate this part of the cerebral cortex, what would happen? Well, it'd be like you're receiving what? Like a tickling sensation in your midsection, right? Or over here, a tickling sensation on your foot. Or let's go over here, right? Or what? Like a sensation on your lips or around your eyes for some reason. All right, so again, we see another little person. This is what? A homunculus of the sensory cortex. So what do you have to know for that? The primary somatosensory cortex is what? The postcentral gyrus. The primary motor cortex is the precentral gyrus. Now, why do we say somatosensory cortex? Somatic sensation is on the surface of your body. You can't feel when you have a heart attack, when you have an appendicitis, when you're having a baby, things like that. Certainly you can feel that. That is what? The visceral sensation. That's sensation from deep inside your body, as opposed to on the surface, which is somatic. Somatosensory means coming from the surface of your body. Okay, so that shows some important functions of the frontal lobe. The parietal lobe is the primary sensory cortex for what we just looked at, touch, pressure, pain, and temperature on the surface of your body. The temporal lobe contains the primary auditory and olfactory areas. Let's see if I can find that pretty quickly. Maybe on this diagram. Oops, what happened to it? Right here. Okay, so the primary auditory cortex is right here in the temporal lobe. So if we were to electrically stimulate this part of the temporal lobe, somebody would have the sensation of hearing something. Okay, when we get to senses, I'll show you the organization of this in a little bit more detail. Maybe if we were to stimulate three separate parts of the auditory cortex, what would somebody hear? What do you need to make three sounds? If you put three sounds together, what do you get? Anybody know? You get a chord. Okay, blah, blah, blah. That would be a chord if all played together. Okay. Wernicke's area, all right, is close to the primary auditory cortex, but it also includes part of the occipital lobe and part of the parietal lobe over here. We call this Wernicke's area. This is where sounds, okay, are converted into language. So you hear sounds, and then these cells over here send signals into Wernicke's area. Those sounds then are organized and interpreted to be spoken language. So a damage to this part of somebody's brain, right, you might be able to hear sounds, you might be able to hear language just fine, right, you might even be able to spell out words that you hear, but since this part of the brain is damaged, you won't know what those words really mean. Okay, and even though you might be able to speak properly, okay, you might be able to generate your own thoughts about certain things and speak properly because Broca's area is just fine, you won't be able to carry on a conversation because you just can't interpret what somebody is saying. All right, so that's another interesting part of the brain. The last part of the brain, or the cerebrum, is the occipital lobe. And the very end right here, the posterior tip of the occipital lobe, is the primary visual cortex. So things coming in from the retina or visual signals go to the primary visual cortex, right, where they're analyzed and then sent to the more anterior parts of the occipital lobe, where then they're further refined. So for instance, in the primary visual cortex, you might see patterns of black and white, for instance. And then those patterns are sent to the visual association area, and then the visual association area can say, you know, is that just a Rorschach diagram of nonsense, or does it really, do these areas of black and white actually form letters and words and things of that nature? Okay, so then information is passed on, and all these different areas of the brain do communicate and share information. The insula is deep to the temporal lobe, and that's the gustatory cortex. What is the sense of gustation? I don't think I've ever mentioned it in this class. But gustation is taste. So if we were to electrically stimulate that area, then you would have the sensation of tasting something, even though there's really nothing in your mouth whatsoever. Okay. So we talked about hearing, vision, taste. So in order for you to perceive your reality, these electrical signals have to reach the cerebral cortex. And without a functioning cerebral cortex, you'll have no perception of any of these different kinds of stimuli that are in our environment. Now, there's a part of the diencephalon that signals in the spinal cord have to stop at before they go to the right part of the cerebral cortex. Does anybody remember what that structure is? It acts as a relay station for signals coming up the spinal cord before they get to the proper location in the cerebral cortex for your perception of reality. What's that called? Yeah, that's the thalamus, right? That's the thalamus. So maybe you can kind of remember where that thalamus is. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, white matter. What the heck is white matter? Especially in the cerebrum. Well, white matter anywhere in the central nervous system. What's white matter? Myelinated axons, so think of these as wires carrying information. They're carrying action potentials over long distances, right? And there's three kinds of white matter. We got commissural, association, and projection fibers. So one way to think of fibers is maybe, white matter is either being sensory or motor, but another way to think of it is by this designation right here, commissural, association, and projection. So let me see if I can find some of these diagrams right here. Okay, well, I tell you what, this diagram is pretty good because I guess I want to go back just a little bit. We see gray matter right on the surface of the brain, nerve cell bodies and dendrites. When these depolarize, they'll give you the perception of reality or maybe will signal motion in certain parts of your skeletal system. All right, so I see white matter, and then guess what I see right here and right here? Oh, you don't see it. Okay, now you do. So look, this is kind of like a transverse section through the brain. So here's frontal lobe. What's down over here? Occipital lobe, and then what's over here? This is a trick question. Look where we're looking. We're looking right through the temporal lobe, right? So temporal lobe, parietal lobe would be up over here. So we're a little bit below the parietal lobe in the temporal lobe. Now, does this look like white matter to you? No, it's not white matter. This is gray matter. What's gray matter once again? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites. So these are special signal processing units deep inside the brain, these gray matter areas. And these are what we call, and it's mislabeled in your book, but for years and years these were mislabeled. These are called the basal ganglia. But in modern nomenclature, what would we call these areas of gray matter in the central nervous system? What is gray matter in the central nervous system? That is what we call a nucleus, right? So these are the basal nuclei in common language, but I think your book still uses the older language, calls them basal ganglia. But now, where would you find ganglia according to a modern designation? Not central nervous system, but peripheral nervous system, right? So this is just kind of a carryover before the language was developed. Well, now I can see gray matter right here. These are special parts of the motor part of your nervous system, right? And these basal nuclei allow the cerebellum to control your body when it's in motion. In particular, these basal nuclei right here, whenever you want to contract the biceps brachii, of course, you cause it to contract by thinking about it. But what has to happen to the triceps in order for the biceps to cause flexion of your forearm? Yeah, it has to extend. That means that the triceps has to relax, okay? But under normal circumstances, there's a normal tone of all muscles inside your body, which means that they're normally contracted a little bit, protecting joints and making sure that you don't fall out of your chair right now. But nonetheless, when you contract as biceps brachii, that means now that triceps has to relax. And so that's the job of the basal nuclei, is to relax antagonistic muscles. So if there is a disease process in the basal nuclei, when somebody contracts their biceps, what happens to the triceps? It stays contracted, so a person is fighting the tension that's developed by the triceps, so their motion is very rigid. It's very awkward. If they trip on something, they can't catch their balance. When somebody speaks, right, then the muscles of articulation don't work properly, their speech is slurred when that happens. Okay, and that disease process is called Parkinson's disease. So Parkinson's disease is a disease of these basal nuclei, which are deep inside the brain right here. Okay, there is, they rely on a neurotransmitter called dopamine. And once upon a time, back I think in the 60s, okay, there were drug addicts that liked to abuse heroin. And so somebody had a really bright idea of making some synthetic heroin and sold it to a bunch of addicts, people that were addicted to heroin. And that heroin bound to the dopamine receptors, right, of the basal nuclei right here, and it poisoned the basal nuclei for the rest of the lives of those people that ate that however they got it into their body. I'm not sure if they smoked it or injected it or whatever. All right, so it poisoned the basal nuclei, and then they were frozen for the rest of their lives. So their brain, their perception of reality was fine. They wanted to communicate, but they couldn't move any skeletal muscles inside their body as a result of that. Okay, so that was kind of like a huge artificial Parkinson's disease that just developed overnight. And today, people still think when there's an early onset of Parkinson's disease that it is related to drug abuse. And you probably know somebody, maybe not personally, but do you know anybody that has an early onset of Parkinson's disease? Who's that?
Hal Early.
Yeah, I don't know him. Hal Early?
No, Hal.
Hal Early. Hal Early. Probably late 20s, early 30s. Okay, so usually it happens when you're in your 60s. Okay, 70s, but Michael J. Fox had an early onset of Parkinson's disease, and everybody was muttering underneath their breath, oh, well, you were just a drug abuser. But where is Michael J. Fox from? He's from Canada, and when people would just point blank ask him, were you a drug abuser? He would say no. And so, since I know he's from Canada, I would say, oh, well, he's probably telling the truth, right? But what do you know about Michael J. Fox? He was a child actor, right? And then people kind of put two and two together. And remember when they film on a set, they keep the set open for hours on end, maybe 12, 16, maybe even 20 hours at a time. Well, it's impossible to keep a child up for that period of time. So now everybody suspects that there was a producer that laced the drinks of all the child actors on that TV show with amphetamines or other kinds of stimulants that then affected the basal nuclei inside their brains. And there are a couple other people, child actors, in that particular series that came down with early onset Parkinson's disease as well, which is horrific to think of that, okay? So, don't forget, so the basal nuclei are involved with what? Controlling motor function inside our bodies, even though it's not strictly located in the frontal lobe, but that's what their job is. Okay, and that's the degeneration of the basal nuclei is involved in Parkinson's disease. And I don't think I want you to know the names of the individual basal nuclei, like the putamen and substantia nigra and globus pallidus, but you should at least know where they are, okay, and that it's what, gray matter deep inside the central nervous system. Oh, I know what I was saying. Association fibers and things like that. Let's get back to that one. Association fibers, commissural fibers. Let's look at... Okay, so here are... each of these arrows right here represent axons that are going from the thalamus to different parts of the cerebral cortex. All right, so what can you tell me about these axons? Are they going to be gray or white? They're going to be white. They're going to be myelinated. All right, and myelinated axons are what? Tracts in the central nervous system. So these are example of projection tracts that are going from inferior to superior, which would be what kind of information? Afferent or efferent? That would be afferent. All right, but then there can be other neurons from the cerebral cortex that are going down into the spinal cord. Those would be what? Efferent tracts. But nonetheless, if they go from superior to inferior, if tracts go from superior to inferior or inferior to superior, we call those radiation tracts, okay, or projection fibers. So projection fibers are ascending or descending tracts from the cortical gray areas, right, to lower parts of the brain. One example is the internal capsule. So let me find that internal capsule. I want to go over to this region right here. Oh, I got a better view, I think. All right, so here is just a coronal section of the brain. And let me zoom in because I just want to look at the brain, not these other parts. All right, so here's a coronal section. So here are some temporal lobes right over here. And here's the cerebral cortex. So we have nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and I can see some dendrites right there. That's going to send signals. Oh, that's not the one I want. Okay, this is sensory. I want motor. Ah, this is better. All right, so I want some kind of efferent pathway. So what part of the cerebrum initiates motor activity in your body? At least somatic motor. Somatic motor is what? Somatic motor is on the surface of your body, skeletal muscle. Okay, our somatic effector organs. So where are these nerve cell bodies? Well, the cell bodies are going to be in the gray matter of the cerebral cortex, but what part of the gray matter of cerebral cortex? Some of you that have lab maybe can see what I'm talking about, but if this is the first time you've thought about this, it's a stretch to remember. But it has something to do. Is it the precentral gyrus or the postcentral gyrus? Which is the lobe of the brain that is motor? Precentral, right? Because that's where the motor is in your car, right? So here is the precentral gyrus. Oh, and it even says primary motor cortex is what? The precentral gyrus. So here's the cell body. Here is an axon. As it's leaving the brain, going down into the spinal cord, it goes between the thalamus and the basal nuclei. And this right here is what we call the internal capsule. So what kind of matter is internal capsule? Is it gray matter or white matter? It's white matter. And what kind of fibers pass through this internal capsule? Afferent or efferent? It's going to be efferent, yeah. So the internal capsule is just white matter, and it is just an efferent pathway of taking action potentials or nervous impulses down toward the spinal cord. Okay, so there's the internal capsule. And that is what? A projection fibers, because signals are going from superior to inferior. All right, there are other ways that signals move in your brain. All right, so let me get this out of the way. There are commissural and association fibers. All right, commissural fibers connect the different hemispheres of the brain. All right, so it goes from the right to the left hemisphere. And you're saying, well, gee whiz, you know, I thought that longitudinal fissure is really separating the cerebral hemispheres from each other. How do signals get to and from the cerebral hemispheres? And that's because there is a bridge between the right and left hemispheres that we call the corpus callosum. Let me find the corpus callosum. Okay, so here is the cerebrum, frontal, right, parietal, occipital lobe, and then from here all the way down to here is a longitudinal fissure, and then this C-shaped structure, here is the corpus callosum, and there are tracts that go from right to left through the corpus callosum. So So the right side of the brain can figure out what the left side is doing as long as the corpus callosum is intact. Corpus callosum contains commissural tracts, right? Tracts that carry information from right to left. There are a couple other places that can do that as well. Anteriorly, just below the corpus callosum, here is the anterior commissure. So what's the job of this anterior commissure? What kind of information is being... What is the function of this anterior commissure? It's making sure that the right hemisphere can share information with the left hemisphere. So it's information going from right to left, not superior to inferior, but right to left. And then, okay, there's also a posterior commissure. I don't see it on this diagram. It might be on this diagram. I just don't see it. But it would be in this region as well. And again, that's for sharing right sided information with left-sided information, because the cerebral hemispheres are not exactly equal in their ability. Okay, and association fibers are ways of taking information from one gyrus and sharing it with a neighboring gyrus, like going from the primary auditory cortex to go into the association areas of the visual cortex. So those fibers don't go from right to left. They don't go up and down. They just go from one gyrus to another, like just going right underneath one of these sulci right here. Okay, so those are all going to be myelinated axons. So what do we call myelinated axons again? They're called, in the central nervous system, groups of myelinated axons are tracts. Okay, they're tracts. So commissural fibers, association fibers, and projection fibers all make tracts within the central nervous system. And tracts are made out of what? White matter, right there. Okay, so that takes us to cerebellum. Where the heck is the cerebellum? So here's cerebellum. And I see white matter in the cerebellum. And again, I see gray matter in the cortex. And that little pattern that we see is what we call the arbor vitae. We don't see that pattern necessarily, well, we don't see that pattern in the cerebrum. And what does arbor vitae translate to?
Tree.
Yeah, tree, something tree. It's the tree of life. So when somebody does an imaging study, when we see a nice separation of gray matter and white matter like that, with these nice convolutions on the surface of the cerebellum, then you pretty much know that's a, at least at a structural level, that's a nice functioning cerebellum. But if that pattern disappears, or that even if that pattern disappears in the cerebrum, then that produces deficits in that individual. Okay, so arbor vitae and the function of the cerebellum, okay, is for maintaining balance. So for instance, the primary motor cortex is going to send signals down to your leg muscles for walking. Okay? And how do you know that you're walking properly? Well, the muscles are also sending signals up to your brain, telling your brain how much they're contracting, how far joints are moving and bending, and all that information gets integrated in the cerebellum, right? So that if you start to fall over, if a joint starts to bend more than properly, or if a muscle starts to stretch too much, then the cerebellum can correct that error. It sends signals back down to muscles so that you do not lose your balance. And again, I suppose baseball players have a really advanced cerebellum, right? And so you can develop muscle memory and improve upon various kinds of motor reflexes by just practicing those reflexes and training different neuronal pathways within the cerebellum so that you have better balance and control of your body. So that's the job of the cerebellum. All right, spinal cord extends from foramen magnum down to the second lumbar vertebrae. Can you remember where your all the different vertebrae are in your body? Where's lumbar? Okay, so here's a pretty good picture of spinal cord. Maybe here's even a better picture of the spinal cord. So here is the foramen magnum, and I can see the spinal cord, and it stops right about here, which is lumbar 2. So 3, 4, 5, right, contain no spinal cord, but I do still see a bunch of nerves down in this region right here. I'm going to have to zoom in so that you can see it. All right, so here is the end of the spinal cord, and here are a bunch of spinal nerves that first course down inferiorly, and then they exit the vertebral column. How does a nerve exit the vertebral column? What's this space between vertebrae called? What do you call a hole in a bone? A foramen. So what kind of foramen is this right here? Remember, you got to put two vertebrae together to see it. This is the intervertebral foramen, right? Intervertebral foramen, and it leaves. Right? So, and that's because neuronal tissue can't grow as fast as the musculoskeletal system when somebody's developing, you know, growing up. So the spinal cord can't grow as fast as the vertebral column, so it kind of looks shrunken inside the vertebral canal. But nonetheless, these nerves still go to their effector organs. This tip of the spinal cord is called the conus medullaris because it looks like a what? Looks like a little cone right there. And all of these nerve fibers that are below the conus medullaris, what does that remind you of? A cauda equina. What's a cauda equina? What's an equine? What's an equestrian? Equestrian is somebody that can ride a horse, right? Cauda equina. And what's cauda mean? Tail. That reminded somebody of a horse's tail. All these nerve fibers down right here. And then the very center is a ligament, and we call that the phylum terminale. All right, so the phylum terminale goes all the way down to the coccyx right here and puts a little traction on the conus medullaris so that the spinal cord doesn't retract back up into the brain. All right, sometimes during development, that phylum terminale is really, really short and there's an adhesion between the conus medullaris and the coccyx. And as somebody grows, what happens to the spinal cord? It gets stretched, right? And it produces a lot of nerve damage and deficits in that individual. And we call that a tethered cord. And that adhesion then has to be released. And hopefully that's caught very early on. And then that abnormality can be reduced or even prevented from occurring. All right, so we see some spinal nerves. A spinal nerve is a nerve that actually leaves the central nervous system and becomes part of the peripheral nervous system. So I see some lumbar spinal nerves, I see some sacral spinal nerves, and up above, what were you going to see? Some cervical spinal nerves and thoracic spinal nerves. These are all leaving what? The intervertebral foramina. Now, when you look at a spinal cord, does the diameter or does the width of a spinal cord look uniform from the cervical region down to even the lumbar region, or do some regions look thicker? Yeah, some look thicker. Like in this cervical region right here, this is a cervical enlargement. And then there's one down below it called the lumbar enlargement. Why do you think that is? What parts of your body, what parts of your body do you have two of that kind of get attached to your trunk in this region here and this region here? Yeah, your appendages, right? So there's special processing units, special neurons, interneurons, groups of them, and these parts of the spinal cord that help control your upper appendages in the cervical enlargement, and then which help control your lower appendages here in the lumbar enlargement as well. All right, let's look at some more things regarding this spinal cord. Let's take a look at this figure right here. That's not too important. Except that shows you that the end of the spinal cord occurs right about at L2. There is cerebral spinal fluid that surrounds the brain and spinal cord, and sometimes when you have an infection in the brain or spinal cord, those bacteria and viruses can end up in the cerebrospinal fluid. So sometimes to diagnose that condition, what do we call that condition when somebody has an infection of the brain? That's called encephalitis. And you think that's serious or maybe not too serious? Really serious, because your brain is doing what? Controlling everything in your body. You can't really live very long without a brain at all, right? So sometimes that cerebral spinal fluid has to be withdrawn from the brain or spinal cord with a needle, aspirated out. Where is a good place to get that cerebral spinal fluid? Like drill a hole through somebody's cranium? Okay, get it out. Or jab a needle into a thoracic region right here and suck some out. better because at least you can go through what? An intervertebral foramen. You don't have to drill a hole in a bone to get it out, but there's a better place. Where is there a better place that's in your vertebral column right here that doesn't have part of the spinal cord? Anything below L2, right? So typically we call that a spinal tap. So spinal tap is performed, right, anywhere below the region of L2 because you have some nerves there, but nerves have a tendency to get pushed out of the way and not lacerated, and cerebrospinal fluid can be sucked out right in this region right here. Okay, and I think we talked about these different curvatures of the spinal cord before. All right, now what about gray matter and white matter in the spinal cord? All right, so here we have a nice vertebrae. Ooh, what kind of vertebrae does this look like to you? Oh, this is a blast from the past. Cervical. Why do you say cervical? I agree completely. Transverse foramina, bifid spinous process, right? So that should all come back to you. Here is the vertebral body. Here is the vertebral foramen. And of course, if you line all of those up, you get the vertebral canal. And inside the vertebral canal is the spinal cord. But there are some layers of connective tissue, too, that which we'll get to next time. Right? These layers of connective tissue we call the meninges. We'll look at these layers next time. And then even exterior to the meninges, there's some other connective tissues. Right, so one layer of the meninges is the dura mater, and then on top of the dura mater is the epidural space, which contains fat. And so sometimes these nerves can be anesthetized by injecting a little anesthetic into this epidural space and anesthetize these nerves so that you don't have pain sensation coming from that one part of your body. Right, and so that's good for anesthesia, really handy because why would you want to give an epidural to somebody? For instance, if you give general anesthesia to somebody, especially if they're pregnant, you're not only giving anesthesia to the mom, who else are you giving anesthesia to? The unborn baby. That's real dangerous, right? And it's even dangerous for a person to get general anesthesia. So if you can just anesthetize some small part of your body, then it's not nearly as dangerous a circumstance, right? All right, so now look at the difference between the spinal cord and the cerebrum. Where do we find white matter in the spinal cord? Superficial or deep? Yeah, the cortex part of the spinal cord is white matter, but where's gray matter? It's in the more medullary parts, right, the deeper parts, which is opposite compared to the cerebrum. So these are what we call horns of the spinal cord. Here is the dorsal horn, here's the ventral horn, here's a lateral horn, and these are nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And then this right here is what we call the central commissure. Because what's a commissure? It takes things from right to left. Right to left is a commissural thing. And then I can see a little central canal in there. All right, so we're going to start with this slide next time, which is going to be Wednesday. And we'll finish up central nervous system on Wednesday. And there's the fancy sign-in sheet if you need it.